Chapter 2. Corner, the reader must not expect to know where I live. At present, it is true, my abode may be a question of little or no import to anybody, but if I should carry my readers with me, as I hope to do, and there should spring up between them and me feelings of homely affection and regard attaching something of interest to matters ever so slightly connected with my fortunes or my speculations, even my place of residence might one day have a kind of charm for them. Bearing this possible contingency in mind, I wish them to understand, in the outset, that they must never expect to know it. I am not a churlish old man. Friendless I can never be, for all mankind are my kindred, and I am on ill terms with no one member of my great family. But for many years I have led a lonely, solitary life. What wound I sought to heal, what sorrow to forget, originally, matters not now. It is sufficient that retirement has become a habit with me, and that I am unwilling to break the spell which for so long a time has shed its quiet influence upon my home and heart. I live in a venerable suburb of London, in an old house which in bygone days was a famous resort for merry roisterers and peerless ladies, long since departed. It is a silent, shady place, with a paved courtyard so full of echoes, that sometimes I am tempted to believe that faint responses to the noises of old times linger there yet, and that these ghosts of sound haunt my footsteps as I pace it up and down. I am the more confirmed in this belief, because, of late years, the echoes that attend my walks have been less loud and marked than they were wont to be. And it is pleasanter to imagine in them the rustling of silk brocade, and the light step of some lovely girl, than to recognize in their altered note the failing tread of an old man. Those who like to read of brilliant rooms and gorgeous furniture would derive but little pleasure from a minute description of my simple dwelling. It is dear to me for the same reason that they would hold it in slight regard. Its worm-eaten doors, and low ceilings crossed by clumsy beams, its walls of wainscot, dark stairs, and gaping closets, its small chambers, communicating with each other by winding passages or narrow steps, its many nooks, scarce larger than its corner cupboards, its very dust and dullness, are all dear to me. The moth and spider are my constant tenants. For in my house the one basks in his long sleep, and the other plies his busy loom secure and undisturbed. I have a pleasure in thinking on a summer's day how many butterflies have sprung for the first time into light and sunshine from some dark corner of these old walls. When I first came to live here, which was many years ago, the neighbors were curious to know who I was, and whence I came, and why I lived so much alone. As time went on, and they still remained unsatisfied on these points, I became the center of a popular ferment, extending for half a mile round, and in one direction for a full mile. Various rumors were circulated to my prejudice. I was a spy, an infidel, a conjurer, a kidnapper of children, a refugee, a priest, a monster. Mothers caught up their infants, and ran into their houses as I passed. Men eyed me spitefully, and muttered threats and curses. I was the object of suspicion and distrust, of downright hatred too. But when in course of time they found I did no harm, but, on the contrary, inclined towards them despite their unjust usage, they began to relent. I found my footsteps no longer dogged, as they had often been before, and observed that the women and children no longer retreated, but would stand and gaze at me as I passed their doors. I took this for a good omen, and waited patiently for better times. By degrees I began to make friends among these humble folks, and though they were yet shy of speaking, would give them good day, apostrophe and so pass on. In a little time, those whom I had thus accosted would make a point of coming to their doors and windows at the usual hour, and nod a courtesy to me. Children, too, came timidly within my reach, and ran away quite scared, when I patted their heads, and bade them be good at school. These little people soon grew more familiar. from exchanging mere words of course with my older neighbors, I gradually became their friend and adviser, the depositary of their cares and sorrows, and sometimes, it may be, the reliever, in my small way, of their distresses. And now I never walk abroad, but pleasant recognitions and smiling faces wait on Master Humphrey. It was a whim of mine, perhaps as a whet to the curiosity of my neighbors, and a kind of retaliation upon them for their suspicions it was, I say, a whim of mine, when I first took up my abode in this place, to acknowledge no other name than Humphrey. With my detractors, I was Ugly Humphrey. When I began to convert them into friends, I was Mr. Humphrey and old Mr. Humphrey. At length I settled down into plain Master Humphrey, which was understood to be the title most pleasant to my ear, and so completely a matter of course has it become, that sometimes when I am taking my morning walk in my little courtyard, I overhear my barber, who has a profound respect for me, and would not, I am sure, abridge my honors for the world, holding forth on the other side of the wall, touching the state of Master Humphrey's health, and communicating to some friend the substance of the conversation that he and Master Humphrey have had together in the course of the shaving which he has just concluded. That I may not make acquaintance with my readers under false pretenses, or give them cause to complain hereafter, that I have withheld any matter which it was essential for them to have learned at first, I wish them to know, and I smile sorrowfully to think, that the time has been when the confession would have given me pain, that I am a misshapen, deformed old man. I have never been made a misanthrope by this cause. I have never been stung by any insult, nor wounded by any jest upon my crooked figure. As a child I was melancholy and timid, but that was because the gentle consideration paid to my misfortune sunk deep into my spirit, and made me sad, even in those early days. I was but a very young creature when my poor mother died, and yet I remember that often, when I hung around her neck, and oftener still when I played about the room before her, she would catch me to her bosom, and bursting into tears, would soothe me with every term of fondness and affection. God knows I was a happy child at those times, happy to nestle in her breast, happy to weep when she did, happy in not knowing why. These occasions are so strongly impressed upon my memory, that they seem to have occupied whole years. I had numbered very, very few, when they ceased forever, but before then their meaning had been revealed to me. I do not know whether all children are imbued with a quick perception of childish grace and beauty, and a strong love for it, but I was. I had no thought that I remember, either that I possessed it myself, or that I lacked it, but I admired it with an intensity that I cannot describe. A little knot of playmates, they must have been beautiful, for I see them now were clustered one day round my mother's knee in eager admiration of some picture representing a group of infant angels, which she held in her hand. Whose the picture was, whether it was familiar to me or otherwise, or how all the children came to be there, I forget. I have some dim thought it was my birthday, but the beginning of my recollection is that we were all together in a garden, and it was summer weather, I am sure of that, for one of the little girls had roses in her sash. There were many lovely angels in this picture, and I remember the fancy coming upon me to point out which of them represented each child there, and that when I had gone through my companions, I stopped and hesitated, wondering which was most like me. I remember the children looking at each other, and my turning red and hot, and their crowding round to kiss me, saying that they loved me all the same. And then, and when the old sorrow came into my dear mother's mild and tender look, the truth broke upon me for the first time, and I knew, while watching my awkward and ungainly sports, how keenly she had felt for her poor crippled boy. I used frequently to dream of it afterwards, and now my heart aches for that child, as if I had never been he, when I think how often he awoke from some fairy change to his own old form, and sobbed himself to sleep again. Well, all these sorrows are past, My glancing at them may not be without its use, for it may help in some measure to explain why I have all my life been attached to the inanimate objects that people my chamber, and how I have come to look upon them rather in the light of old and constant friends than as mere chairs and tables which a little money could replace at will. Chief and first among all these is my clock, my old, cheerful, companionable clock. How can I ever convey to others an idea of the comfort and consolation that this old clock has been for years to me? It is associated with my earliest recollections. It stood upon the staircase at home, I call it home still mechanically, nigh 60 years ago. I like it for that. But it is not on that account, nor because it is a quaint old thing in a huge oaken case curiously and richly carved, that I prize it as I do. I incline to it, as if it were alive, and could understand and give me back the love I bear it. And what other thing, that is not life, could cheer me as it does? What other thing, that is not life, I will not say how few things, that have, could have proved the same patient, true, untiring friend. How often have I sat in the long winter evenings feeling such society in its cricket voice, that raising my eyes from my book and looking gratefully towards it, the face reddened by the glow of the shining fire seemed to relax from its staid expression, and to regard me kindly. How often in the summer twilight, when my thoughts have wandered back to a melancholy past, have its regular whisperings recalled them to the calm and peaceful present? How often in the dead tranquility of night has its spell broken the oppressive silence, and seemed to give me assurance that the old clock was still a faithful watcher at my chamber door? My easy chair, my desk, my ancient furniture, my very books, I can scarcely bring myself to love even these last like my old clock. It stands in a snug corner, midway between the fireside and a low arched door leading to my bedroom. Its fame is diffused so extensively throughout the neighborhood that I have often the satisfaction of hearing the publican, or the baker, and sometimes even the parish clerk, petitioning my housekeeper, of whom I shall have much to say by and by, to inform him the exact time by Master Humphrey's clock. My barber, to whom I have referred, would sooner believe it than the sun. Nor are these its only distinctions. It has acquired, I am happy to say, another, inseparably connecting it, not only with my enjoyments and reflections, but with those of other men, as I shall now relate. I lived alone here for a long time without any friend or acquaintance. In the course of my wanderings by night and day, at all hours and seasons, in city streets and quiet country parts, I came to be familiar with certain faces, and to take it to heart as quite a heavy disappointment if they failed to present themselves each at its accustomed spot. But these were the only friends I knew, and beyond them I had none. It happened, however, when I had gone on thus for a long time, that I formed an acquaintance with a deaf gentleman, which ripened into intimacy and close companionship. To this hour, I am ignorant of his name. It is his humor to conceal it, or he has a reason and purpose for so doing. In either case, I feel that he has a right to require a return of the trust he has reposed. And as he has never sought to discover my secret, I have never sought to penetrate his. There may have been something in this tacit confidence in each other flattering and pleasant to us both, and it may have imparted in the beginning an additional zest, perhaps, to our friendship. Be this as it may, we have grown to be like brothers, and still I only know him as the deaf gentleman. I have said that retirement has become a habit with me. When I add that the deaf gentleman and I have two friends, I communicate nothing which is inconsistent with that declaration. I spend many hours of every day in solitude and study, have no friends or change of friends but these, only see them at stated periods, and am supposed to be of a retired spirit by the very nature and object of our association. We are men of secluded habits, with something of a cloud upon our early fortunes, whose enthusiasm, nevertheless, has not cooled with age, whose spirit of romance is not yet quenched, who are content to ramble through the world in a pleasant dream, rather than ever waken again to its harsh realities. We are alchemists who would extract the essence of perpetual youth from dust and ashes, tempt coy truth in many light and airy forms from the bottom of her well, and discover one crumb of comfort, or one grain of good in the commonest and least regarded matter that passes through our crucible. Spirits of past times, creatures of imagination, and people of today are alike the objects of our seeking, and, unlike the objects of search with most philosophers, we can ensure their coming at our command. The deaf gentleman and I first began to beguile our days with these fancies, and our nights in communicating them to each other. We are now four. But in my room there are six old chairs, and we have decided that the two empty seats shall always be placed at our table when we meet, to remind us that we may yet increase our company by that number, if we should find two men to our mind. When one among us dies, his chair will always be set in its usual place, but never occupied again. And I have caused my will to be so drawn out that when we are all dead the house shall be shut up, and the vacant chairs still left in their accustomed places. It is pleasant to think that even then our shades may, perhaps, assemble together as of yore we did, and join in ghostly converse. One night in every week, as the clock strikes 10, we meet. At the second stroke of 2, I am alone. And now shall I tell how, that my old servant, besides giving us note of time, and ticking cheerful encouragement of our proceedings, lends its name to our society, which for its punctuality and my love is christened Master Humphrey's Clock. Now shall I tell how that in the bottom of the old dark closet, where the steady pendulum throbs and beats with healthy action, though the pulse of him who made it stood still long ago, and never moved again, there are piles of moldy papers constantly placed there by our hands, that we may link our enjoyments with my old friend, and draw means to beguile time from the heart of time itself? Shall I, or can I, tell with what a secret pride I open this repository, when we meet at night, and still find new store of pleasure in my dear old clock? Friend and companion of my solitude. Mine is not a selfish love. I would not keep your merits to myself, but disperse something of pleasant association with your image through the whole wide world. I would have men couple with your name cheerful and healthy thoughts. I would have them believe that you keep true and honest time, and how it would gladden me to know that they recognized some hearty English work in Master Humphrey's Clock. The clock case, it is my intention constantly to address my readers from the chimney corner, and I would fain hope that such accounts as I shall give them of our histories and proceedings, our quiet speculations or more busy adventures, will never be unwelcome. Lest, however, I should grow prolix in the outset, by lingering too long upon our little association, confounding the enthusiasm with which I regard this chief happiness of my life with that minor degree of interest which those to whom I address myself may be supposed to feel for it, I have deemed it expedient to break off as they have seen. But, still clinging to my old friend, and naturally desirous that all its merits should be known, I am tempted to open somewhat. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.